Hello. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming out on this most British of holidays, Halloween. And my name is Chris Berzins. I'm a former editor of Millennium Journal of International Studies, which, as many of you will know, is based in the Department of International Relations here at the LSE. Tonight is part of the Millennium Speakers Series, and we're very delighted to have in the chair tonight for this event Professor Robert Wade of the LSE's Development Studies Institute. And just before I have Professor Wade introduce our speaker tonight, I'll just let you know that we have a number of books outside that you can have a look at on your way out. We have copies of Millennium Journal, including our last special issue, as well as the author's books, John Ralston Saul's books, that are on sale outside as well. And with that, I think I'll turn over to Professor Wade.
Thank you. Thank you. It is my privilege to introduce John Ralston Saul. Let me just tell you a few words about his background, which will help you understand where he's coming from and what he says tonight. And then I'll say something about the book, which is the subject of his talk. He is a writer about philosophical and political economic issues of our time. Many people would consider those two things as antithetical, philosophical and political economic. He brings them together, and very unusually, he spans the divide between fiction and non-fiction. He has published several novels, including one called The Birds of Prey. He has written several books of philosophical essays, including one called Voltaire's Bastards, The Dictatorship of Reason in the West. The Dictatorship of Reason in the West. And now he has just published the latest book, which is available outside, The Collapse of Globalization and the Rebirth of Nationalism. You can tell from these titles, The Birds of Prey, Voltaire's Bastards, and The Collapse of Globalization, that he is a hard-hitting critic of much of what he sees around him. It will help you to understand where he's coming from, to know that he comes from the northern part of North America, rather than the southern part. And in particular, it will help you to know that his wife is the recently ex-Governor General of Canada, so that he presumably has been writing the book called The Collapse of Globalism, in the splendor of the Governor General's mansion in Ottawa. Now let me say something about the book itself, The Collapse of Globalism. And what I want to do is just, in the space of a couple of minutes, signal to you two of what I take to be its really important themes, that is, the themes of the book, The Collapse of Globalism. The first theme is that what we call globalization, the shift, the worldwide shift to a liberal market set of economic policies over the past 25 years, this move to globalism in that particular sense, liberal market economics, is not working. It's not working as seen in lots of evidence that the rate of progress over the past 25 years from about 1980 has quite dramatically slowed down compared to the rate of progress over the previous 20 years from 1960 to 1980 for most of the world's countries. Of course, China is a big exception, but for most of the world's countries, the rate of progress has dramatically slowed down. And the second important theme has to do with the point that economic nationalism, quote unquote, can be a force for good. In particular, the book argues for a role of the state in the economy, which is not mainly to adjust the internal political economy to the preferences of international finance, but rather the role of the state is to construct a public space in which decisions about limiting the scope of market forces, about embedding markets in a social democratic framework, can be made in line with a conception of the public interest, a conception which is derived through a legitimate political process. This public space cannot be global. The only viable unit, or certainly what the primary viable unit, has to be the nation state. And at a time when many on the left have basically given up on the whole idea of the welfare state, this is, I think, a refreshing argument. The book tries to be realistic without being defeatist, and perhaps you could sum up the message by saying that the book recognizes that Mrs. Thatcher's favorite word, namely Tina, does not have to stand for there is no alternative. It can also stand for this is no alternative.
Wonderful being introduced by Professor Wade, because he really knows how to do an introduction properly. I'm thrilled to be here, having a PhD from a college across the road, King's, and so it's delighted to know I'm allowed in. I think you came quite close to some of the things that I'm trying to do in this book and in my other books. We spent a lot of time today talking about what an individualistic world this is, how people speak out and think out in different ways. My feeling is that we're really in a relatively conformist era, and that universities, unfortunately, are a large part of the problem of conformism because of the specialist way in which teaching is done, particularly in departments of economics, where I think Professor Wade and I'd probably agree on this, there hasn't been, with very few exceptions, much profound rethinking of economic thought for a very, very long time. And most of this inevitable truth, which is basically a temporary theory called globalism, is the cobbling together of a couple of 19th century ideas with a lot of number crunching added on top of it in order to give the impression that it's something new, whereas it's actually something relatively old. The one place where I might slightly differ with the introduction is that what I'm trying to do is to step back and say, look, this is a theory. It may have some wonderful things in it. Some things work, some things don't work. Why can't we have a reasonable conversation about this? Why can't we look at what works and what doesn't work? Why is it that we have to be faced with either being on side or being the enemy? Why is it that when we point out, for example, failure of growth in a whole bunch of parts of the world, suddenly, well, that means you're a protectionist, or you're an old-fashioned nationalist? You simply can't have a reasonable conversation about how economics works in reality, and what kind of rethinking of economics is actually needed at this point. The sort of rethinking of economics that happened at the end of the 18th century, and frankly at the end of the 19th century, and really, with the exception of a few wonderful figures, has not happened for a very long time. So we're sort of skating along in a world in which the real economic thinkers, who were to a great extent economic historians, were ethnically cleansed from the departments of economics around the world, promoting the sort of, they were the aristocracy, if you like, promoting the middle class, the sort of macroeconomists, up to the top. But that's not such a big problem. The big problem is pushing the microeconomists, who are really just numbers crunchers, up to a position of severe respectability, as if they had ideas, to the point where their ability to crunch numbers in such quantities means that the macroeconomists are actually frightened to move without them. So you're actually in a kind of Louis XV situation, you know, with a monarch who really doesn't quite know how to run this court that lies beneath him. So in a sense, economics has been turned on its head. with the number crunchers driving the people who think a bit and the people who really think not in the court at all. Anyway, that's a sort of nice soft opening. You'll notice it's called the collapse of globalism, not the death of globalism. I'm very careful about that. You know, Nietzsche said God was dead, and you know, he turned up running the United States. you know, Francis Fukuyama said history was dead, and he ought to have resigned his seat at the university, but anyway, he didn't. So things don't just appear out of nowhere and suddenly in the space of 5 or 10 years become inevitable truth forever, and everything that was before disappears. And that, you know, we were talking about the fact that, you know, if you're a Keynesian, for large parts of the 70s and 80s, you couldn't even get your articles published in journals which were controlled by the truth. Not the other side, suddenly the truth. The absence of a kind of conversation. Well, I don't believe in that kind of approach. It's collapsing, it's collapsed, it's failing, it has had some successes. But we don't actually know where we're going. So that sort of idea that things come to an end and something else starts is part of what I would consider to be the classic weakness of Western civilization, which is a great talent for denial of its own reality and the reality of the West is we love ideology, and we spend most of our time denying that we love it, this country in particular, by defining itself as a place of common sense and so on and so on. It's been one of the great centers over the years of great truths which appear and then disappear. So, when you say that you feel there are some problems with globalism, you're immediately attacked as being, you know, old-fashioned nationalist or in favor. I don't know why you're sitting down there behind this enormous box. I mean, I sort of feel a little bit bad. If you want to move over, you really should, because I don't know what I can do about this. I don't have an axe, so if you want to move, you know. That if you're doing a critique of globalism, somehow you are afraid of the world. You want to put up barriers as another kind of truth, as opposed to particular barriers at particular times. The point is really this: internationalism has always existed. Nothing new about internationalism. Globalization, is a very particular school of internationalism, driven by a very particular interpretation of economics. It's a narrow view of economics, and it is a narrow interpretation of internationalism. When these movements start out, and I must say I spent a lot of time writing this book, going back and reading what they were all saying in the 1970s and 80s. Not just the extremists who said, you know, the nation state will die, but the vast majority of the people who were speaking in universities, in departments, in politics, in favor of this movement, and looking at what they said, and you should really thank me for that, because that is a really boring task. But one thing about the globalists is they can't write. There are a few exceptions, and in fact, Martin Wolf is an exception. He can write, but his articles are a lot better than that book, where half of the book is actually a great defense of globalism, and the other half completely contradicts himself, which makes it fun, because it shows he's smart, that he's able to contradict himself, even unconsciously. So internationalism has always existed. We had mercantilism. We had the 19th century free trade. We had those astonishing empires. I mean, the way in which the world is integrated today, the efficiency with which the world is integrated today, is nothing in comparison to 3 or 4 19th century empires, and the manner in which they were able to combine free trade and empires. Because one of the problems is that trade is usually studied in departments of economics, and empires are studied in departments of history and politics. Whereas in fact, of course, they were intimately linked. So that you were able to produce this theory of free trade as a pure theory in the 19th century without having to deal with the fact that a large part of the theory of free trade was based upon using the empire as a sourcing system for raw materials. And then the free trade was actually between a very small number of European and, let's say, Western democracies or Western-style countries. And if actually you want to look at the one, you know, if you want to look at for the really, really successful internationalist movements, I mean, I would have thought the Roman Empire or, say, the Catholic Church. You know, the Catholic Church is a really successful internationalist movement. It's been going for a couple of thousand years. It's still going strong. It rolls with the punches, redefines itself. May not like what it stands for. But what I'm saying to you is that internationalism has many faces and many forms, and they change through time. Globalization is a recent, narrow, specific view. And in the beginning, when I went back and looked at what they'd all said, their views of what globalization would lead to were very clearly laid out by them. And if you want to judge the movement, you have to go back and look at what they said it would do. They have to be judged by what they promised, by what they predicted. And it was very, very clear. You can tell when things are falling apart because the people who are the great believers, as their movements get into trouble, start changing their arguments very radically. So suddenly, globalization is everything. Globalization is, well, gosh, students are taking break years and traveling around the world. Isn't globalization wonderful? Nothing to do with globalization. The fusion food, that's nothing to do with globalization. I mean, you have a kind of conversation about the nature of globalization, which is basically just flimsy, gauze-like, evaporates as you advance towards precisely what they said it would do, precisely what they said it would produce, precisely what effects they said it would have on the world. So, what's globalization? I hate definitions, and I actually don't really think they did anymore. All they do is put you on a plank and then someone pushes you off. Globalization, through their eyes, not through my eyes, it's not my definition, it's their definition, but I'm quite good at, as you heard from the titles, I'm quite good at taking really boring, long things and jamming them together into a couple of lines. Globalization was essentially an idea that civilization, inevitably, and from now on, and forever, thousand-year right and all the rest of it, forever, would be conceived, constructed, seen, sieved, whatever you like, through economics. It wouldn't be through politics, it wouldn't be through armies, it wouldn't be through race. I'm not saying these are good or bad, I'm just saying that now and forever, inevitably, the world would be seen through an economic prism, and things would be judged through the economic prism. And indeed, until 2 weeks ago, when the Protocol on Cultural Diversity was signed in Paris, how many of you have heard of it? Just, this is kind of interesting. Not a bad group. Until that was signed 2 weeks ago, the concept that was dominant was that culture itself at the international level would be regulated through economic mechanisms. An astonishing idea, something which had never been even imagined, let alone tried before in history. As a result of this idea that essentially the world would be seen through economics, doesn't mean everything else disappears, but that would be the driving force. We saw something quite surprising happen at the international level, and that was, can you hear me? At the international level, and that was for a 25-year period, almost no, and I say almost just in case I'm wrong, almost no international binding treaties were signed in non-economic areas. Almost. On the other hand, dozens and dozens and dozens of binding international treaties were signed in the economic area. So what you actually had happening was you took one part of the nation state or the region out of the nation state or the region where it was counterbalanced with, for example, tax law and laws of justice and laws of work conditions. You took it out and you took that to the international level and you left everything else at the national level or sometimes at the regional level. And you made it binding at the international level, and nothing else is binding at the international level. In so doing, created a kind of imbalance at the nation state and at the regional level. And that was both the brilliance of the movement, the political strategy, and of course the fatal flaw, because inevitably means something when it's about things coming to an end. Inevitably, it would lead to an imbalance, which would in fact bring into doubt and bring into question ability to work, principally because people would notice it wasn't working in the way it was announced. just to give you a bit of an idea of what I'm talking about.
I was in a very different university the other day, Johns Hopkins in Washington, and speaking, and the dean, an economist, a very well-known economist, was introducing me. And before we went in, you know, he said, gosh, this is very long, I'll just name a couple of these books. And I said, well, you know, why don't you just, because I'm quite proud of it, you know, I just got Pablo Neruda medal, and I'm the only Canadian to get it, and they're giving it out for the 100th anniversary, and there's an independent jury, and there are only 100 of them taken out around the world. So I'm kind of proud of that. And, you know, I'm Pablo Neruda, very tall, so 20th century, certainly in Latin America, maybe top two or three in the world. I didn't say what I just said, you know, I'm quite proud of it. And so he got in, and he went through this, and he said, oh, yeah, and, and he just got this medal named for this guy, Pablo Neruda. And I suddenly saw the Latin American students who had been worshiping him realize that the most famous economist, the man who was telling them how to reorganize the world, had no idea who Pablo Neruda was. And then afterwards, he came up to me and said, you know, I didn't want to speak because I was caring, but I just I was part of the IMF's, you know, refunding negotiations and so on, and putting in place all of the IMF policies for Latin America. And I suddenly realized that you tend to make this kind of stuff up. That one of the key people thinking about how Latin America is to be structured doesn't know who Pablo Neruda is.
So what was his name?
Don't remember. And you suddenly, and that just summarizes for me exactly how isolated from reality this movement could be. And of course, he will never be able to go into a class again because Latin American students can be taken entirely seriously. I almost wanted to say to him, Marquez, I just didn't want to embarrass him even more, but. What, in a way, this movement is, it's been a very strange marriage, if you look at its foundations, its roots, of 19th century free trade theory, which, interestingly enough, was small l liberal to a great extent, but very deeply religiously based. Right? And at the same time, 19th century anti-democratic free market theory, anti-democratic, anti-involvement of any sort of government. And somehow, these two opposing, if you like, movements of the 19th century were cobbled together in a rather bizarre way by a couple of thinkers, quite interesting thinkers, in the middle of the 20th century and then came to power in the 1970s and 80s, without anybody actually saying, how do you put those two movements together? And if you put those two movements together, you have to go back and re-examine what those two movements meant at the time and whether it's possible to cobble them together in a meaningful way. Anyway, to do this in a reasonable amount of time, if you look at the promises were pretty straightforward, and they were repeated endlessly in academic papers, and speeches, and policy papers, and so on. One way or another, the nation state would weaken, debate about how much it would weaken. Economics would dominate. We would arrive very quickly as a result of these two things at debt-free governments, which would remain out of debt forever. There would be waves of trade, which there have indeed been, which would lead to a rising tide, which would raise people out of poverty. There would be a rising tide of competition. And of course, in effect, what's happened is, I'm just taking there five things to make a list of 25 promises. There are five, really, of the central promises. Well, of course, today we look around, and we see that the nation state is probably stronger than it's been since the Second World War. We're in a period of rising nationalism, some of it really interesting, and some of it really awful. But the fact is, whether it's positive nationalism or negative nationalism, returning citizenship or returning racism, loathing, belief in the purity of the group or whatever, you're seeing a return of this nationalism all over the world. Economics, you'll notice if you actually start looking at most of your papers and so on, you'll notice that economics has slipped from the front page, generally speaking, to the second, third, and fourth pages. That it's no longer considered by normal people to be the dominant force. The debt-free governments. Well, the country that that theory came out of now has the largest debt of any country in the history of the world. There has been an astonishing growth in trade in this period of globalization. It's about, about 20, 22 times what it was, about 10 times. I don't know what it was, 15 times. I like to be generous and take the top number they're giving, 22. But this, and the same thing, the increase in foreign investment, increase in the amount of money in the marketplace, oh, it's phenomenal growth, incredible success story. So then you move over to the other side, and Robert made reference to this, and you look at GDP, real wealth growth, and you discover that this has been a period, on average, of, at best, average growth, and in general, mediocre growth, particularly in the OECD countries. So, I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that, of course, as trade goes up, and as investment goes up, so growth should go up in an equivalent amount. Not that naive. But you'd think that if you had one of the greatest increases in the history of the world in growth, that you would get some kind of sign on the wealth side. Instead, there's been basically no sign at all, with a few exceptions, which can be dealt with in a context which has very little to do with globalism. And so you have to ask yourself why, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. We always talk about one of the most unfortunate things of the last quarter century, turn of a growing increase in rich-poor divide. But even if you put the two pieces together, you know, a little group of rich with all that money and the rest of the people, you put that together, the total is still not very impressive. It's still a period of average to mediocre growth. It was supposed to be a period of increasing competition. Here, I feel very confident in saying that this has been a period of declining competition. That in this period, which was supposed to be about deregulation, get the taxes down, allow the marketplace to rule, we've actually seen the return out of nowhere of oligopolies and monopolies at the international level. I mean, I'm dyslexic. I hoped I'd never have to spell the word oligopoly again after I got a university, you know. They're everywhere, suddenly. So that suddenly a movement which said that it was in favor of the marketplace has in fact produced a return of monopolies and oligopolies. And I think it could be argued, very interesting argument to have, that in fact what has happened in the globalist period is that we have regressed to a pre-capitalist period, which was called mercantilism. And mercantilism had various characteristics. But of course, one of the characteristics of mercantilism was large transnational corporations which controlled production, from production through to sale. You know, Hudson's Bay Company, India Company, French East India Company, Dutch East India Company, and so on. You know, from the silkworm to the lady in the ball gown. And you could, by controlling it as the elements, the raw materials, the semi-produced, by controlling the production and the gradual manufacture all the way through, you were able to control price and quantity, and thereby get the profit you wanted. And the reason that people were against it, one of the reasons was that, of course, they felt that it did not permit proper growth. It prevented proper growth because it prevented wealth creation. Now, I don't know if any of this sounds familiar, but it seems to me that that's a pretty accurate description of a transnational. What makes a transnational capital? They're not owned by anybody, they're owned by people like us, speculators, buying stuff for profit. They're not owned by anybody who's interested in any long-term way of the outcome. They're not run by anybody who owns anything. Run by technocrats, they're run by bureaucrats. And they move things across borders in a way which prevents wealth creation at each border that they cross. So I think it could be argued, I'm not sure I'm right, but I think it would be worth having an argument, as to whether we haven't actually regressed, or progressed, any kind of term, to a pre-capitalist period to a great extent, if you take into account that apparently, according to their numbers, not mine, about 60% of the 22 times growth in international trade, about 60% of the international trade is actually bits and pieces moving inside the structures of transnational corporations, leaving only 40%, which is still an increase, but a much smaller increase. So today, what have we got? What's the situation today? 5 years ago, the mainstream of true believers said, you know, isn't it fabulous? China's buying in wonderful China's coming. Then a couple of years ago, people started getting nervous about jobs and so on. And the same people said, you know, you left people, you people were in this area, but you know, that Manichaean argument. You lefties, you know, what have you got against the poor people of China? And I almost thought it was that piece of food on your plate, the poor people in China. What have you got against the poor people in China? Don't they have the right to sell their goods and so on? And then suddenly, about 6 months ago, these same people, the true believers in globalization, realized they were sitting in a valley, they looked up this enormous hill and saw 23 million tons of goods rolling down the hill at them. And realized they didn't believe in globalization. And started shouting at the international level that China wasn't playing fair and China couldn't do this and China couldn't do that and that China would have tariffs imposed on them if they didn't impose them on themselves. That the argument in favor of protectionism has not been made, except marginally, has not been made by the left, the old left or the unions. It has principally been made by the advocates of globalization. It's an astonishing, intellectually speaking, if I may say, an astonishing event in which nobody's saying, but wait a minute, you said the opposite 2 years ago. Do you or do you not believe in free markets? Well, what it seems is that they believe in globalization absolutely, providing its headquarters in the West. And that they can use China to draw goods out of it in a British East India Company manner as it suits them. But if it can be centered somewhere else in the world, then they don't believe. It's really as simple as that. At the same time, and I'll come back to China, it's a very interesting case because, of course, it's typical of us that we would think that China has bought into globalization. What, you know, this provincial narrow-mindedness of the West, that anything that anybody else does in the rest of the world, we thought of it first and they're imitating us. The Chinese were doing capitalism. And they don't believe any of our theories about the relationship between capitalism and democracy and all that stuff because they've done it many, many different ways over the decade, over the century. And the way they're doing it has nothing to do with Western theory. It is not influenced by Western theory. It is not driven by Western theory. It's driven by a Chinese idea of how to look at their own issues. It's not terribly surprising whether you like it or not. Brazil. I take Brazil as an interesting example because one of the key mistakes along the road of the Asset Tree was the inclusion of international intellectual property in the WTO. And interestingly enough, it was the beginning, really serious beginning, of a division in the conforming economist community. Because up to that point, there wasn't much argument going on inside that community. And there was the expelled. But those who had not been expelled, they were basically in agreement. And suddenly, from that moment on, someone like Bangwadi said, well, I'm in favor of globalization, but I think intellectual property has nothing to do with trade. It's dishonest and it's immoral to WTO parties to let it go. And a number of the other key globalist economies parted company and said, we are against it. You started to see a very refreshing division open up inside that very conformist community. But Brazil did something absolutely fascinating, which was, of course, 2 years ago, they were one of the frontline countries when it comes to the threat of AIDS. And they basically just decided that they would ignore international economic law. And they said, well, we're just going to make the drugs, and we're going to give them away. And we said, we're going to drag you before international tribunals, you can't do this, you have to call the lawyers. Brazilians said, well, we're going to do it. We did it, and the American down that road. But it was just, these are signs. What I'm describing to you are some of the existential events which are causing people to realize that the world could go into a different way. For better, for worse, we don't know that yet. September 11th is a very interesting factor in the decline of globalization. Why? Well, for a number of reasons. But one of them is, up until September 11th, the myth that there was some kind of virtual state being built to defend that nation states of Asian power, and that the leaders of nation states, since 1974 or 5, leaders of nation states have increasingly been saying, I know there's bad inflation, but there's very little I can do because, there are global forces at work that have to do it. And they use this to excuse almost everything they want to do. Just got it back. But I can't do anything. And in a way, that obsession with the economic solution dominated until September 11th, September 12th. The theoretical new leaders of the world, leaders of the international and the people who work with them, suddenly had to get back to work. The economy was going to fall, they were sometimes falling. They really had no option. And the leaders of our country suddenly realized this was extremely serious. And then the leaders of this large corporation, having gone back to the debt, did what they always do, which is when there's a crisis, cut investments, cut risk. And of course, if you have a massive slash of investments by enormous corporations around the world, you have just accentuated the decline in question. So, prime ministers, presidents, ministers of finance, heads of national banks, woke up and thought, my God, actually have to do something. And they got on the phone, they got on airplanes, they went to meetings, they gave interviews, they printed money, they did everything they could possibly do. And they calmed the panic. And in calming the panic, they prevented us from falling. And in the process, discovered that they hadn't been castrated after all. That they actually had it all. And that they could do all sorts of things. And they began to get the confidence political policy. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's good. Some of the things they might do afterwards might be really awful. But the point is they began to believe that political leadership at the national and regional level really meant something and was not an outcome of economics. Next example, New Zealand. The crisis that led to the really success story of globalization in the 70s, the ability to get power. New Zealand a bit later for a bunch of reasons, and there was a panic in the early 80s. I would say a panic that pushed a little further. It wasn't quite as bad as it was. It was pretty bad. You had an election, which was not on adopting global economic theory, but it turned out that they had a minister of finance and a policy deputy who believed in it completely and was And through two ministers, very, very quickly, you began to see that they sold off pretty well everything government owned, and plus there was an atmosphere to sell off anything major to bring in cash. They brought in some one-time cash, but then they had a permanent outflow of royalty payments that had to be made to foreign owners, thereby creating a permanent downward pressure on their economy. Unemployment went up, the kids started leaving, the growth went down, a disaster. And then in 1999, after an election campaign in which the two parties that won specifically said they would remove New Zealand from the globalist threat, which doesn't mean go back to protectionism, it means try something else, which would be a more sensible mix. The government was elected on the basis of those promises and set about doing exactly what they said they would do, which was to say put some regulations back in, bought back their airline, created a bank to install loans, whole series of things. And I'm, of course, closing the whole the first time in the history of New Zealand democracy, or the oldest democracy in the world, the party has been just by a slim margin re-elected for a third time. The first time that's happened to, I think, either to any government or certainly to a Labour government. Argentina. I'm sorry. Oh boy, I'm rolling on here. Argentina. Argentina, you know, whole series of problems, collapse. The globalist structures instruct them on how to get themselves out of trouble. And for 10 years, they allow themselves to be subjected to what I call crucifixion economics. You have sinned. You will go on, you know, economically speaking, on gruel, hair shirt, flagellate yourself, and if necessary, we'll crucify you. But you will come off the cross and be reborn, healthy and pure. So they came off the cross 10 years later, looked great, lasted 2 years, collapsed, got back up again, walked a few more yards, collapsed. And then said, you know, this doesn't really work for us. We don't actually believe in globalization anymore. The withdrawal of Latin America from the globalist project is actually astonishing. And we're going to do something different. In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to begin by clearing up our books. So that means we can't pay you our debt. We're just going to default in one of the basic sums of money ever owed. We say you can't do that. It's inevitable. You have to pay. At least you have to allow us to lend you money at the end of the day. And they basically said no and walked away, defaulting on most. And they're doing very well. They're doing very well. So the theory didn't work. It didn't work either way. And a short time ago, the GA ripped up a large portion of the debt, a reasonable portion of the debt owed by, of course, the most indebted. And this is a good thing. You could argue it should have been a lot more, et cetera, et cetera. There are some conditions. I think you can ignore the conditions that they've ripped it up. But the point isn't that they've ripped it up for a bit. The point is that they could have done what they did. Could have done precisely the same thing at any time since 1980. Why did they do it now? It wasn't because of the rock stars. I think the rock stars is a face-saving device for the government in any way. I'm not criticizing. It allowed them to say, oh, well, we just won. You better do it. I think they did it for two reasons. One was that September 11th gave them the courage to do things that their economists and their deputy ministers told them they shouldn't do. Told him, well, Secretary, you told me I can't do it, now leave my office, I'm doing it, which is what a politician is supposed to do. Ignore the advice given by specialists when it doesn't suit reality. Secondly, the default of Argentina demonstrated that you could have a major ripping up of debt without it having any effect on the Western economy, which was one of the threats. If you ripped it up, you know, you're Mrs. Jones. Therefore, you can't do that. And so, for those two reasons, I think they found courage to do it. So let me just tell you how I think this is working. First of all, I think what happens is, particularly in the economic areas, we go in and out of ideologies. Ideologies, economic ideologies, have a tendency to last, I don't know, 25 to 50 years. Soviet Union managed about 60 years, but they had the secret police backing up the economists. You know, but normally, you know, economic theories last in power for a quarter of a century to 50 years. They come back later on in some other form, but they don't last all that long. So what happens is there's a period of true belief. The period of true belief is followed by reality. The theory doesn't perform. Some things perform, some things don't. It starts declining into what I would call a vacuum. The elites go on because, of course, they got power on the basis of true belief. So they can't actually respond to failure very well. And so they're in denial for a long period of time while society is actually running. It's very unusual, because it's full. all sorts of things are happening at the same time. And then at some point, 5, 10 years, we come out of it into a new era, which will either be as stupid, more intelligent, or very intelligent, depending on how balanced and conscious we are at the time. But that period, before it comes to formally to an end, when it actually is already ended, is a very difficult period. Because universities are filled with professors whose jobs have been constructed around the truth of globalism, or whatever the theory was before. Deputy ministers, heads of corporations, consultants, ministers, all of their careers are built on the inevitability of this prolonging itself. And the fact that it isn't actually working out is very threatening. So, let me just ask a couple of questions at the end. How do you actually deal with the reality of this? I'll show you how dangerous the denial is. The other day, Toyota, after a long process, very good company, just a wonderful company, they don't break down, get you Canadian things. Toyota was looking at whether to install a factory in the southern United States or in Ontario. And there were 3 or 4 states. And they narrowed it down, I think, to Alabama. Low wages, low taxes, you know, the perfect globalist model. And in fact, they had had a referendum a few years before on whether to keep their taxes rock bottom or not. But they decided to keep them rock bottom. Corporation, because globalization is inevitable. Well, Toyota decided to go to Ontario. And let it be known that the reason they were going to Ontario was that the public education system was better, and therefore the workers were better educated, and the public health system was a complete public health system, and therefore the workers were healthier. Which meant, of course, that Toyota was willing to pay higher taxes in order to get better educated, healthier workers. In other words, the theory isn't working out as predicted. Actually, smart corporations are perfectly willing to pay more taxes and to accept public policies and to accept regulations if it makes it possible for them to run their corporations in a reasonable way. The other thing that, just a funny little story, you'll see, I'm just giving you little hits to give you a sense of this, of what can and can't be done. One of the theories behind globalization was, well, you know, technology, chicken's going so fast, there's no way you can shape it, there's no way you can control markets. People knew that wasn't true after the big attack on the, I guess it was the pound and the franc. And suddenly, the argument at that time was, that showed there was nothing you could do around gold, whereas in fact, what it led to was the euro, and the euro, of course, was a shutting down of deregulated financial markets in one of the richest marketplaces in the world, in fact, a reinsertion of government. But this story is kind of interesting. I think 2 years ago, Citigroup UK, bond market traders, you know, those young guys, Don Adley-driven guys, had a very neat trick. We used to call it the Vancouver Stock Exchange trick, which was in 2 minutes flat, they sold €11 billion in euro bonds, pressed the market, and bought them all back, and made a nice little profit of 15 million euros, which isn't very much, but guys who like fast cars, it's not bad. A lot of dates, a lot of holidays, and so on. And the theory was, well, what are you going to do about this? You know, technology can't be controlled, technology is inevitable with a borderless world. Well, first of all, criminal investigation. But what's most interesting, reorganize the regulations surrounding European bonds and put speed bumps into the buying and selling. In other words, they regulated the technology which theoretically could not be regulated. And in the process, made it almost impossible to do this kind of thing. They showed the power of public authority, which theoretically did not exist in a global economy. But what they really did, they not only showed that technology can be managed, and it may be managed for very bad things. But they actually reminded us of something very interesting, which is forgotten in this economic theory. And that is that civilization is not about speed. speed is a characteristic in general in philosophical. Speed is a characteristic of barbarism. Civilization, in particular democracy, their characteristic is consideration and taking their time. And they actually demonstrated this very basic philosophical difference through this technological action. So I think that, you know, we're in a period where the economic theories are not working out as planned. We're seeing a return of nationalism, part of it driven by the creation of 25 new nation states with all the Soviet Union nation states who are really interested in being nation states and not very interested in economic theory that says they don't have the power to make decisions. We see a return, a phenomenal return of nationalism in many other Western countries, particularly the United States. And what's interesting, of course, is it's the schoolboy phenomenon, that when the captain of the football team, you know, sings a particular tune and wears a green hat, all the little boys do the same. If the United States is going to be highly nationalistic, it is an encouragement to everybody in the world, whatever they think, whether they like or hate the United States, to become more nationalistic. Milton Friedman, you know, one of the most intelligent fathers of this movement, but a smart man and a man with a sense of humor, which is a sign of, you know, a very important sign in an economist, of intelligence, said, you know, that he advised the 25 newly independent nation states after the fall of the Soviet Union that the first thing they should do was privatize, quote. And now he regretted that because he now believed that the rule of law was more important than the market. An astonishing statement from Milton Friedman. You have to take this. I mean, I could just go on with thousands of comments and examples like this that tell you that we're moving in a different direction. Francis Fukuyama, right, one of the apostles, has written a little terrible book saying that we must have the nation state back stronger than ever in order to defend us against terrorism. That's slightly in contradiction with the arguments in favor of globalism, but he doesn't seem to see the contradiction. Even something like Katrina, the images of poverty in the southern United States have now been seen all around the world, which will make it virtually impossible for any of the believers in the United States to go anywhere outside of their country and say, follow our economic theory, they'll really work for you. I think it's over for 10 to 15 years. So you have a situation today where Africa was never in globalism, Latin America has pulled out and is going in different directions, China is going, and India are both going in very interesting have nothing to do with globalism, the theories of globalism. They have to do with China and India. And if we could just get our heads out and look at it from their point of view, we would understand how they see it. China has just announced a new 5-year plan. You may or may not like that, but the theory that driving this 5-year plan is 5 balances. Domestic, international, inland, coast. So you see the first column, it's all what you might call national, citizen, environment, okay? Domestic, international, inland, coast, rural, urban, society, economy, nature, man. And the instructions are that these are balances in the Chinese idea of philosophy, which is not our idea, and that the governments should, when necessary, always favor the first column over the second. This is not the theory of globalism. So, Europe is stalled, and the United States is in a very nationalistic period. Globalism is now a regional idea. The region may be the departments of economics of many universities in the West. The elites are in denial. Their denial is irrelevant because reality will persist over their denial. They're a little bit like French knights at Agincourt. What we desperately need, and this is where I want to stop, what we desperately need now, the danger is that we could slip completely out of that era into the opposite. And none of us want to see one extreme turning into an opposite extreme. Most of us who have questions believe in some kind of sensible balance in which various considerations are taken into account, in particular human needs and human society. What we're in desperate need of is a really serious rethinking of economic theory, which means the reinvention of the history of economics. So that people who are taught economics actually read Adam Smith all the way through and not just the excerpts. And that they actually read The Theory of Moral Sentiments. How many of you read The Theory of Moral Sentiments? Raise your hand. One. Two. How many of you have heard of the theory of more senses? A third. You know, Adam Smith's gravestone says, "Here lies Adam Smith, author of The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations." His important book is The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Wealth of Nations is a footnote. And in order to understand the nature of the footnote, you take the non, if you like, utilitarian aspects of the second book, and they allow you to you can understand those by reading the first book. But I mean, we need that kind of rethinking of the roots of economic theory. And I will simply give you two possible places to look. One is that the theories of trade and anti-government free market were put in place in the 19th century when we were essentially, in most of the world, in markets of scarcity. We are today essentially in markets of surplus. We are applying theories of scarcity to situations of surplus. This may be the explanation for the almost impossible conundrum of low costs, low wages, and so on. But we haven't examined it. I don't. Maybe we are, but I certainly don't know many people examine it. And secondly, the explanation for the bad relationship between the growth in trade and the slow increase in wealth may be that the mercantilist transnationals actually are not international traders. They are, in fact, 17th, 18th century mercantilist operations, and their trade does not create wealth. When I say that, people are horrified in many economics departments. But why are they afraid to think about it? So the point of the book is to lay out this and many other things in order to, I think, reestablish the idea that it isn't all black and white. There actually is the possibility of rethinking how economics are done at the international level. If we can put in place an international criminal court, which is one of the signs of fraternity, there have been three new binding international treaties in the non-economic area: anti-landmines, international criminal court, and now the cultural diversity soon to be treated. If we can do those things, starting to get our courage back, it means that we can put in binding treaties to deal with oligopolies, to deal with competition, to deal with taxation, to deal with work conditions in a way which will not harm the developing world, to deal with consultants and lobbyists. And that movement will give us the sense that we are not the victims of inevitability and of narrow economic theory. We're actually citizens in countries, on continents, in an international world, and we are capable.
Nature was in the first column.
Right, okay.
Absolutely, because for the very simple reason, and I've heard a surprising number of
debates in which the Western theorists say we must be careful not to force the Chinese to limit their growth in order to follow Western model. Again, that kind of Western egocentrism, which is so astonishing. The Chinese are working this thing out for themselves. They know perfectly well what they've lost some astonishing percentage of their land to desertification. They know perfectly well what the threats are to their environment. So they're trying to figure out how they can get maximum growth without continuing along this environmental road. And they're figuring it out in their own way. And it is not under Western pressure. They're perfectly capable of working it out themselves, thank you very much. And it just, I know we find this hard, horrible, and difficult to accept. But they, you know, read a book. Now, I said some nasty things about a couple of books. There's a wonderful book called The Beijing Consensus.
Where I'm just wondering, you said earlier in terms of somebody taking a gap year or somebody going backpacking, well, that's not globalization. But in terms of more permanent skilled worker immigration, and I think you could say in this the age of globalism that we're coming out of now, in this kind of past or in the collapse of globalism now, what does that mean for immigration? In the past, you know, 30, 40 years, we've seen a massive immigration in skilled workers and things, less where people are migrating less out of kind of desperation and more out of opportunity. And particularly for a country like Canada, where that form of immigration is so important to the national economy, where do we see this decline of globalism affecting immigration in that respect?
What you're seeing is, you heard that. What you're seeing is, when I said there's a return to nationalism, the negative side of it is you're seeing a return to racism. You're seeing large parts of Europe actually panic by really relatively small percentage of the population coming elsewhere. When you're in Germany for a week, you'd swear 50% of the population was planning to listen to the intellectual class. You know, there are 80 million, and there are, I think, 2.2 million Muslims in Germany. So there's a kind of people are getting themselves into a state. When people get themselves into a state about religion and race, they're in deep trouble. And I'm not quite sure. And so this is a very dangerous one. That's why I said that the problem with ideologies is the way out is usually rough. And we're seeing some of that roughness now. Am I saying that the return of racism in Europe is the fault of globalization? Not exactly. What I'm saying is that 25 years of believing that you can run the world through economics means that you miss how a society actually works. And when you suddenly wake up and find you've got real human and social problems, you could have dealt with them if you hadn't thought that everything went through the economic prison. And frankly, I think there's just an enormous amount of work that needs to be done in this area because, you know, Europe, which I guess includes Britain to some extent in this case, brought people in under hypocritical pretenses in the 60s and 70s, which is to say it was a continuation of Taylorism. We need machines, they have to be people. And of course we're decent people, so we'll give them rights, but we won't give them obligations, which is citizenship. And, that set up a kind of a lie inside those societies, which is very hard to get out of. Very, very hard to get out of. But I actually, my pessimism allows me to be optimistic, the right kind of optimism. But it's going to be very tough, and I think it's going to be very close. And as a result of that, it is entirely possible that the worst will happen, that borders will close. You're told borders can't be closed. Borders can't be closed. Anything. Technology can be used to close borders just as easily as to make things go forever.
Yes.
What you thought about? Thank you. Sorry. Can this?
Yes.
Oh, okay, great. I wondered what you thought about the right to development as some kind of conceptual framework, because to me it seems like it sort of synthesizes internationalist ideas with domestic imperatives. In that, it exists in a very sort of abstract form at the moment. But Arjun Sen Gupta and the UN Human Rights Commission have been working on this. And the idea is that the benefits of development accrue to individuals and not abstractions. I wondered if you thought that could be useful or if it's just going to be something talked about by human rights lawyers.
I'm always very nervous. I mean, the difficulty with internationalism is to come up with things that work for everybody, which are not actual denials of difference and of different approaches and of different methods. We provoke the meltdown in Southeast Asia in 97 because we were convinced that there was a single rule that had to do with moving the capital. We were totally wrong. In fact, they were very stable countries with high saving rates and they had all the money they needed to make investments. And we piled, what was it, 100, somebody here must know, was it 100? I'm trying to remember what the billion. Yeah, a large amount of money in a year and then provoked the collapse and took it all out and made the collapse worse. Because we actually thought everywhere was the same. And what was, and what was fascinating for us to see in 98, and this was one of the signs, it's in the book, what I do is kind of go through what I think is the series of events in terms of development, there are so many different models that are possible. Do we mean by development that everybody should head into slums in the cities? Do we mean by development that we should make bedrooms a little bit richer in villages? Do we mean a rethinking? And Indians are dealing with this at the moment, I think, in a highly sophisticated way, and we probably have something to learn from the conscious sophistication with which they're attempting to figure out how to get the best out of what might come from the West, the best out of what they already have inside, and use some of their own methods. I'm not being idealistic in saying they're trying to figure it out while we're pontificating about them.
Yes, JP. Would you want to use the mic?
You talk about the end of an ideology. How radical do you think the change is going to be? And do you think that things can be fixed, for example, in international financial institution? Do you think that the WTO should be abolished or can be fixed?
You know, I think that, frankly, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with having an international organization to regulate trade. That's not a problem at all. The problem is having only an international organization of trade to regulate series of human relationships. That's why this hopefully soon new treaty on cultural diversity is so important. Again, I mean, I really suggest you read it if you haven't read it.
Can I just ask, what is the U.S. position on that treaty?
The vote was, I don't remember the vote exactly, so I'll have to make it up slightly, but only slightly. The last vote was in Paris 2 weeks ago, and it was quite a high number, I remember. So I'll just say 251-1. Yes, sir. Yep. No, they abstained. They voted in the previous vote.
Somebody said Israel also voted against, but you said...
In the previous vote, it was 246-4, I think, and it was United States, Israel, Australia, New Zealand. And the other, I believe, abstained. And the point about this is that it's very interesting from the economic point of view, it's very interesting from the political point of view. There are holes in this treaty, okay? Nevertheless, what it does very clearly, it removes culture, which is a gigantic
point I